This painting and that one over there, and there's one in the library, was done by an artist who was here. I happen to put it here because I want to focus on it for a little while. The artist's name is Daryl Nelson. I do not know him. I do not know what he was intending to paint, but I'm just going to talk a little anyway. Going to be very audacious. But anyway, what I want you to do first is I want you to take like 1 minute, and I just want you to look at this painting. You're supposed to look at this painting.
Is that required?
That's required.
That's required.
For
1 minute.
You have to look at this painting.
Oh, I saw it already.
Okay, now this is heavy, so. Excuse me.
Imagine you
now
look at the easel.
No. Now I want you to list the colors you saw.
Green.
To yourself on your paper. Don't talk about green. See how many colors? What colors did you see? Okay, let's turn it around. Actually, I came in here a little early to count the colors he used, and I lost track. So I was gonna say, hey, there's 46 colors here. And I said, nah, I'll just do this a little more easily. Okay. Just excuse me a minute here. Tell me if I'm aiming right.
You got it.
You can't write down any more colors.
No more colors. Okay. How many people got more than six colors? All right, 10. Okay, one of the things I wanted to point out too is, I mean, you could have put blue, right? All right, look at the blue. There's turquoise blue, lavender blue here. There's a different blue here, cerulean blue. Turquoise, darker turquoise there. And look at here, just the range between the dark blue to the pinkish blue. In this amazing range of the blue. And here, just in this line right here with this green, well, there's sort of a gray, but 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different shades of green.
Mm-hmm. If you put generic green, doesn't that cover it?
No, I do.
Okay, so one of the main things I wanted to point out by that is often we look at something, we catalog it, and we set it aside in our mind file. We really don't look at it. We really don't see it. And down here, if you really look at this, you could say, well, it's browns. But it's not. I mean, there's peach, orange, red, blue, yellow, turquoise, ochre. I mean, there's a ton of colors there. Partly what he's doing is creating a lot of movement with the color, but it's something we don't often see. I'm sure all of you saw this. It's red. Red spot. And this color up here, magenta, and it actually fades into yellow. Some of these you may not see because you're further away. But I guess it's just sort of like in paintings and in nature and people and places, we often catalog too soon. We don't really allow ourselves time to take in what we really do see. I mean, it goes in, but it doesn't go in. You know what I mean? And David, did you leave the room? Okay, what's he wearing? David, you're not. Get out of sight. You're missing all day.
Black shirt.
Get out of sight. You're right messing it up. Okay, plaid. What are the colors in the plaid?
Blue and red.
Green and brown. Green and brown and.
Red.
Red.
Yellow.
Okay, what kind of blue pants?
Blue.
Jeans.
Jeans.
Okay, and what do you have in his t-shirt? Did he have socks on?
No.
Yeah.
What did his t-shirt say?
I refuse.
Something he's
on.
Okay, what kind of glasses did he have on?
Rim.
They're gold rimmed and they're squashed this way. I mean they're sort of narrow this way.
All right. How did he walk out of the room?
Fast.
Angrily.
Petulantly.
Okay. Is there anything that you felt like when he was walking out of the room, as far as not just the visualness of, you know, what he's wearing, but did you notice anything else about him that you just like to comment or that you thought or felt as he walked out?
He moves with energy.
Energy.
Probably very accepting. I mean, as if he's used to things like this.
He was. Come on here, David, you're now.
I was wondering how he felt sent out of the three rings ago, how he felt about being dismissed from my room, but my own daughter. Did he know about it? Did he feel like he wanted him out for something? I didn't know if he was sending him for chairs or making him at the same time.
All right, how did you feel when you went out?
Well, I felt a little bit like I was sort of banished. I mean, I knew I was going to be asked to leave, but I did feel like it was rude. I mean, that the joke about it being rude, I hadn't planned. And so I had a tinge of, I'm leaving something and I want to stay here.
Okay, tennis shoes? Very good tennis shoes. Did anyone get the gray socks? Okay, they're not Levi's, light blue pants. And it says, I refuse to have a battle of wits with an unarmed person. Okay, the shirt, is it what you remember?
I thought it was clean.
Red.
I
got the red. No.
Okay, now, Elmer's not here. So I'm going to ask George to do it because he's really a good sport. I mean George. Chuck.
Chuck
Lutz. Why are you George? It's on your list. Come on. Okay. Now here is a person that we have heard speak with a lot of authority who is an authority, right? I mean he's got a position that's in the ALC that's quite responsible. What's your official title?
Director, Office of Church and Society.
Sounds pretty good. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't quite make it because he has Levi now. Okay. When you look at him, what do you see?
Defensive.
White male.
His hands folded.
A little bit of a forced smile.
And in his pocket.
Wishing he had gone to the other.
I see a guinea pig that's unhappy.
I think he's enjoying it.
All right. Okay. Now turn him around. Now, he is now a waitry. A waitress. Do you have, as you see this person, I want you, it's really hard to do. He was a teacher, now he's a waitress. Do you see in the same way? Do you experience him as you see him in the same way?
He's a little too old for a waitress.
Well, I'm not here.
Meaning that's my perception. I'd wonder, because most of, I don't know if all of them are, but a lot of them are younger.
Some are older.
Okay, turn around. Now he's Narnia leader.
He's having fun. Well, see, he's smiling now, and before he wasn't.
Yeah.
He didn't like me. Much more than the teacher.
All this is just a really simple example of how we pocket people by where we see them and what they're doing. Rather than just seeing Chuck, you know, he comes in, he sits down, he does a very good lecture, he knows his subject, immediately we see him in a certain way. We walk somewhere else and someone else is doing something else, we often catalog people by what we see them doing. Or sometimes it's by what they're wearing. It doesn't work here. But I'm just saying that oftentimes with our seeing, we don't really see. We sort of group.
Yeah.
Sorry. We label. Now I'm just talking about how we really don't often use the facilities, the faculties, the abilities we have, because what we've done is we've gotten busy with our looking. You know, where we say we either don't want to handle that group of people, so we box them, or we don't want to, we maybe just don't want to relate to that person. Or we do want to relate to them because of the position they're in. Do you understand what I'm trying to get at here? And I think a lot of this relates to the actual act of seeing. How we interpret how they're standing, how we interpret how they're looking at us.
Thank you.
One of the things that I feel as a visual person in a verbal society is that somewhere along the line, the society got a little askew, and that we have not really felt that learning to see is essential. Even in the schools, it's reading, writing, and arithmetic. Art, music, they're extra. And I'm trying to say that I feel to be a complete person and to have our children be complete people, I would even go so far as to say that art and music possibly are even more important than some of the others in the area of developing a full person. Okay? That's debatable, of course. I have a bias. So I'm coming from that bias. And I think that if we don't do this, if we continue in our society where we don't use these gifts we have, the really gift of seeing, then in fact, we, I guess we're just losing the full possibility of being human. I've got a few poems here that I wrote. And what I want you to do is to sort of either close your eyes or just think and see if you can see through the words. One thing poetry is I think, sort of a crossover between the verbal and the visual. But it's not if we don't let it come. Now, I have a bias because I've seen these, so I don't know if I could communicate to you or not. But there's just a few. This one is called New Mexico 3. The pines, stunted by sun, spot the surface tension. Deep dark green, touches of night, hang on into the red gold earth, canopied by the giver, becoming part of each other. Okay, that came from a very specific scene in New Mexico where there were dark green trees and red earth and a blue sky. It was a way of trying to communicate what I saw and felt. It isn't just the physical act of seeing. That's the next step. Okay. The sky grays into rain as the air cools my neck. My shoulders become aware of the air, the space they inhabit. The spring event moves in from the west, encompassing. And I'll just read a couple more. No, not that one. Not that one. I couldn't decide which ones to read, so I did a couple here. Okay. The wind wafts, flows amongst the tree trunks, not aimlessly, but directionless, in the sense of music, flowing, filling, yet omnipresent. Or the spot in one's mind which evolves into encompassing after viewing spring's first red tulip. And just here. The crisp evenings need not be filled. They overflow already as autumn begins. No task calls louder than the smell of falling leaves in impending night, nor the rustling of corn stalks flickering through my nose. Mellowness returns to the land and carries me into itself. Now, what I would like to have as a challenge to everyone here is to in your mind, to see something, someplace special for yourself. Someplace special that you've been a lot, and that either means warmth or coziness or, you know, sort of, I suppose, home. Or security. Anyway, in that realm of feelings, imagine a place, imagine a specific place. And after you have the picture in your mind, see how much you really can see of that place. Do any of you have any places you'd like to share or talk about? Or do you have no places?
I do have a place. It's in the lodge. I was going to leave the States for a period of time, and when I came back, the home I was raised in would no longer belong to my folks. And I went around smelling the house, So I added that to see. But the freshness of our house always struck me. And the room that was the brightest and the lightest was the bathroom. It was a light pink and white with pink on the curtains. And the windows were open and fresh air in. Mm-hmm. And it was, I don't know, that one of the rooms stuck in my mind the most.
Yeah. And I would say probably you were seeing with your whole person.
Well, I know the smell was important. In other places I've been, I can recall the smell as well as the scene. Mm-hmm. Color too.
Anyone else?
I think of my kitchen and around, we have a round kitchen table. And I mean, I can picture the kitchen vividly because I've put everything in there, you know, so I can picture it vividly. But I think of the round table and everything that's gone on around that table, you know, from laughter and love to tears and sadness. But it's the place of warmth for me.
Mm-hmm. One more? Anyone else?
Well, I have a place from my childhood that was... There was a hill behind our old house in the country, and up on the top of the hill was an old weathered barn, which is no more. But when I think about childhood, I'm always there because it was a dreaming place. There was an old apple tree that went through the seasons, and I can just remember summertime especially, and the grass and the smells and that beautiful old barn. And it was calm, it was peaceful, but it was also a place of dreaming.
Now, each person that spoke saw it vividly. They had warm feelings, it was secure, good feelings. It was like the total person experienced this. Am I right? I mean, you were there. I would bet, well, I can't really say it that way, but I guess I should speak for my own self. I'm 39, and there are not a whole lot of visual pictures like that. For 39 years, that's a lot of minutes, a lot of hours, a lot of times. I have their very specific places, but a lot of my life, I've forgotten. A lot of the places I've forgotten. A lot of things I just went through. Okay, now flip if you can. These are hard mental exercises. Flip if you can to an event or, no, it has to be a place, but some place which holds a lot of tension, a lot of anger or pain or anguish, that you have a picture in your mind, some place where you just have feelings of dislocation or anger or, we say, in that basket. Do any of you have a place like that that you'd like to share?
Intensive care unit in a hospital. Not that I have ever been in one, but visiting people. A place that really stands out in my experience. Do you want visual impressions?
Yeah, visual impressions.
Overlit. Lots of instrumentation that was meaningless to me, so they're not sort of jumbled. It's a jumble kind of visual impression.
Mm-hmm.
Chords and lights and dials and over the place.
And you're feeling when you see that in your mind.
Real nervous, real scared, intimidated, powerless.
Anyone else wanna share?
I'll share something which is interesting. When she said that, I saw several things. A car wreck that my wife had been in right in front of our house. An emergency room. That's not important. The important thing is that I couldn't come up with one. When you wanted the pleasurable thing, my problem was to focus on one. It was boom, whole bunch of them. But when you wanted the painful thing, I still had the feeling there was a whole bunch of them, but I couldn't look at them.
Hmm.
And she said that. I said,
it
yeah,
opens
that's.
Up.
I have some of that same experience. And then I remember what it was like. I remember what it looked like, what it felt like.
Hmm.
But no, couldn't get there on my own.
All I wanted to do with that part is for each of you in yourself to look at how you feel and see through your own self. Some of you, I would presume, didn't like the exercise to begin with, so it didn't hassle at all. But there are probably some of you who did have some difficulty in seeing even the, well, let's see now, which one should I choose? I couldn't get into it. There were some of you who probably saw thousands, you know, I can't focus, or some saw a specific place. And then on the negative part, so people say, well, I haven't had anything really bad happen. I am not cataloging and saying one is better or another one is, you know, more together. I'm just saying for each of you to see, how you remember, how you feel through your memories, because our eyes are one of our main inputs. And if we cut off what's around us visually, we're cutting off tremendous amount of knowledge, feeling, growth. And Holden especially, of course, is full of things. But I guess one of the things that I keep juxtaposing in my mind is I live in Los Angeles, and there's a tremendous amount of graffiti. And I personally don't like it. I mean, I'm quite aware that there's a whole art world that is going with it, but I personally don't like it because it's an affront to my eyes. I feel like somebody's invaded the neighbor's wall, and so on. So I have all these feelings. But I keep seeing that when I see the mountains. And it's very hard for me not to see them both. And I don't know what my mind's doing, but all I'm saying is I'm trying to catalog it. I'm trying to realize I am seeing these both at the same time. What could that possibly mean? I feel that seeing is work. It's something that we all do, but it requires work. It requires you to connect some part of yourself. It doesn't have to be verbal, but it requires you to connect part of yourself and to stop if you're going to see. For instance, an artist, while they are working, I'm using an artist in the sense of a visual artist right now, but this could go in any realm, is so concentrating, especially for an artist, for a musician it would be the ear, is so concentrating about what they are looking at, they're not thinking words. It is going directly, non-verbally, into themselves. I would bet, this person's not here, I don't know him, I would bet is this person created this, that they were not thinking with words until they started to finish it. When they started to say, okay, now this relates to this and this needs some balance and so on, when they started to bring it all together. But I would bet when that person first started, there were no words in their mind. And I think that all of us are capable of doing this in our lives with our eyes, but we just don't practice it. I also think that seeing non-verbally, like in other words, not running it through your computer, not running it through your verbal side of your mind, just seeing is frustrating. Because what we want to do is saying, okay, I see a blue candle, and I kind of count 1, 2, 3, 4, there's not as many candles, and we got it all pat. And we've organized it so we can dismiss it. And what I'm trying to say, I think what we all need to work on is seeing without organizing it, just seeing it so that that you or I are relating to the scene without cataloging. Is this making any sense to you? It's a very difficult concept because what I'm asking is for you to step out of what you've been trained to do. And it's very hard to do. Okay. I would like to suggest that in doing art as a visual artist, that what the artist is trying to do is go through what they see to touch something greater than what they see. I would like to suggest that at this point, the process of seeing for a visual artist is very close to trying to understand what you believe. Does that ring any bells in anyone's mind? Or is that too esoteric?
Feels right.
What, you have something?
Well, I guess I'm back, I'm both with you and back a couple steps. Because when you were talking about not kind of organizing everything we see, I was trying to go back to exercise number one,
mm-hmm.
and say, you know, when you asked me to look at the picture, I did all kinds of stuff. What I didn't do was organize the colors that I was seeing.
Right.
I couldn't.
That was a lousy question.
I'm really glad that I spent a minute with the picture, and I have a lot of other things from the picture that I have a sense are getting towards what you're talking about now, which is, you know, the away from the colors, away from the things that are on the, that are depicted on the painting, you know, what was the artist
right
trying to do?
Right on. It, like you were saying, when you're being an artist, you use the vernacular of the artist that is creating motion with those, and he's, you know, the feelings that are there, they're not colors.
They are though.
No,
but you don't have to be able to tell you what the colors are in order to understand the painting.
See, another thing I could have done with that painting is I could have asked for each person to, after I turned it around, what did you feel? What did that painting create in you? Maybe this will make it clear. One time, a few years ago, I had an art show, and I was working with latex paint at the time, and I really got into how it flows, house paint. And so I was pouring it on plastic, and then pulling, and then it got to be these long strings. I let it dry a day, and I pull it off, so it was just the paint. I was really into a purist stage, you know, what does paint do without any surface? And I pulled it off, and I hung it on wires, you know, different. One of them I did was three concentric circles so that there was a smaller circle in the middle and larger, and what it was is a 6-foot, well, I don't know how many, I never counted, how many strands of just paint hanging on these concentric circles. If you looked at it at a distance, it looked solid. But it was, I mean, any breeze just blew it because there was nothing there really. And this little girl came to the art show. She must have been 4. She wasn't too old. And her mother died when this happened, but she went over to it and she just looked at it and she went right through it. She put her arms out like this and walked right through it. And I just felt great because to me, she was really experiencing. She'd seen something, she experienced it, and she just jumped right in. And I thought it was great. Her mother got so mad. Don't do that, you might break it. But I said, no. She really has gone into the artwork. It's like almost like Alice in Wonderland in the hole. You know, she's accepted what she saw, and she just went right in. And what it called was for her to just move it, you know, with her body. And it was really exciting to me. It was like I had done something and I didn't verbally know what I was doing. I was just doing this. And I felt I'd communicated to this little girl. There were no words. But she had felt something from that piece that I really didn't even know I'd put there. And yet I don't even know if I put it there. It was there. And that's a lot of when I had Chuck stand up here and try to have you change different characters in your mind. You know, of how we see things, how we close things, and how open we are. It's not just artworks, it's people.
Maybe I'd like to make one big sort of off-the-wall connection that's not too dislocating. But one of my experiences of being here at Holden has been a visual experience. And to make a real gigantic jump, this is a room of white people, and we've got a corporate white racism. And I think that probably more, the bulk of that is in how we see and how it's connected. And I'd like to partly explain what I mean. I come from mid-city Los Angeles, and I go out to the supermarket at midnight. 50% of the people are black, 25% are Oriental, 15% are Hispanic, another are Mexico-American, Chicano, another 10% are sort of
whatever
recently arrived Central American, and I am the white Caucasian representative in the group. And so here, and that's sort of what I've become accustomed to seeing over a period and become very comfortable with that. And these 3 days that I've been in Holden, the seeing your faces has made me almost feel a very funny thing that sort of constantly ticks off, like I'm at a big family reunion, or I've died and gone to little Scandinavian heaven. You know, because
There are the Scandinavian Germanic faces, so you all sort of look like old friends or relatives. You know, and I wonder where everybody is. You know, and it's like that sort of constantly ticks off. You know, just, and it's because of my eyes. And then one of the experiences that has stuck from that area has been in the course of a couple minutes in Los Angeles to drive and stop at a street corner where there's maybe 20 blacks. They're big high school kids who are just waiting for a bus to pick them up and take them home. But you put 20 black kids that are big, they're, you know, I want to lock my door.
And you're little.
Yeah, I'm little. You know, so I want to lock the door, and there's sort of an intimidating presence about it that is in my eyes, because they're standing there waiting to go home. Two blocks later, or maybe a mile later, maybe 15 minutes later, depending on where I would drive, I'll be in the same situation, but it will have switched to white. And immediately I can see high school kids coming home from school. They're big. But it's Ozzie and Harriet, you know, and Ricky Nelson on TV. And it's taken me almost a year to really undo that thing that I'm seeing and really just see high school kids standing on the corner waiting for a bus. And, you know, like that's part of what I'm thinking about when I'm seeing that connects and goes into me in a way where how I see is really hindering me in a lot of ways, and also valuing, also doing a lot of things with what I value that I'm not really in touch with. So anyway, I don't know, maybe that's too far. But
no, it wasn't. It relates to what I was saying about how we see people. And I realize that I'm really, I suppose it's really a huge thing to try to do in 45 minutes, but to try to say that the process of seeing is a complex act, and that often we don't take the time to really see what we're seeing. You know, we catalog it and we say, that person is, like you say, the black kids at the corner. You know, we're oppressive. You know, you saw they were mean, you know, or they were going to do something to you. And the other ones, hey, they're just having a good time. That we do that all the time, not just with color. And not just with paintings, and not just with flowers and roads and stuff, but we do it all the time with people, places, and also with ideas too. Because I feel that idea is part of what visual artists are trying to work through. They're working through a medium of paint or sculpture, they're working through towards idea.
We kind of relating to what he says. We live in Northern California. Blacks are very rare in our area. So we aren't associating with the black. So when we get down to San Francisco, I really feel like Archie Bunker, you see? And I say, why don't I grow up to myself? Because I have another reaction, you see? And whatever that reaction comes up in myself, if I see a white woman with a colored man, it's strange to me, and a reaction comes up like Archie Bunker, and I say to myself, why didn't I grow up? And it's hard for me. And so then, consequently, I don't like to face that situation. I like to stay home, you see. Because here I am saying, hey, you haven't grown up yet, and you don't like to say that when you're 60 years old, anyway.
And can I put you on the spot?
Yeah.
I would suggest that that's also possibly a very similar feeling to you handling the waterfall.
It possibly is.
This is a person who is a painter, and he wants to paint the waterfall, and he's sort of afraid to do it.
Because, you see, I've associated one of my dearest friends is a very good artist. And see, we've talked over this waterfall before. And so that puts me on the spot. I have to produce, you see.
But some of the same feelings, right?
I would enjoy, but some of this fear, because, hey, I'm put on the spot, I better produce, because he's going to ask me, what'd you do?
Right. Yeah. I think one of the things we do with people who work in the visual arts is catalog them into a special place. And I don't think people who work in the visual arts are any different than anyone else. All they've chosen is probably to just work more with their eyes, instead of their ears as musicians might, or with words as a writer might. And I really feel that there's a lot of similarities, and we sort of said, oh, they're working with something, I don't understand it, or especially contemporary art. One of the things artists would like the most is for people to just be with whatever they have created rather than catalog it immediately. If you are with a piece of art for any length of time and then you say, forget it, I think that the artist would be a lot more understanding of that. And I think we catalog it out because we don't understand. This is sort of a closing paragraph that really sort of is trying to relate what we're talking about today to tomorrow, because we didn't really talk a lot about how this process of art, or the artist going through, in this case, paint and canvas, or flowers and dirt and logs and so on, into idea, so that we can touch ideas rather than the art. Can I just read this? Okay. Art itself is an instrument, a cognitive instrument, and with religion, the only instrument for probing certain materials and questions. Art and religion probe the mysteries in those difficult areas where blurred and powerful symbols are the only possible speech, and their arrangement into coherent religions and works of art are the only possible grammar. Did you understand what that quote? This is Annie Dillard. In a sense, it's saying that an artist who is seriously working through the visual is trying to reach, to touch, to feel within themselves and through themselves and in touch with the world the same way a person who is involved with understanding or feeling what they believe, and that it is part of the mystery of life, and it is part of that energy or that source that we all try to touch through belief, coming from different directions, of course. Now that might send some of you up the wall, but some of you might resonate to that.
Well, this doesn't apply to that. That has prompted a whole bunch of other things, images in my mind. But for me, I think I have a stronger auditory gift than visual gift. That doesn't mean that I don't have both. Mm-hmm. But music has always been, you know, something very, very special to me, and I can feel through music, you know, the mm-hmm. heights and the depths of my being and whatever else, life and everything. Drawn art, whatever you call it, and, you know, has not sent me the way the art of music has.
Mm-hmm. Right, each person is different, yeah.
Right, and that doesn't mean, I mean, I agree, I think that I can sort of learn to appreciate more and learn to use the visual, my visual skills or channels or whatever you want to call them, but I think innately, naturally, Jane came with the gift of appreciating music a lot, you know, and the other one would have to be more nurtured and
yeah, it's work.
Work, it is. It's
part of really hearing, working. Part of hearing too is work.
I was trying to put some thoughts together too with that last bit that you were talking about, and I was thinking of, you know, God, the ultimate creator, the original creator, if you want to call it that. He has chosen to make himself known to us through his word. Okay, so we have the Bible with all the words, mm-hmm. but he created the world first. He created, you know, everything in it first. And so we continue to have that creation all around us. And just think about, you know, the splashes that he gives us of a sunset or a sunrise or whatever that might be, or a flower with a dewdrop. And so in those moments, we don't think of words. Mm. I mean, it's just there, and it's marvelous, and And he gives us a vision of himself in that, and of indeed what we can be. There's thinking about, say, a summer evening when there's just that hovering between light and darkness, and when everything just feels perfect, and we get this longing inside for something we don't know, and you can't give
it. It's not a word.
No,
it's a feeling
not a
that
word.
You, yeah. And you're getting that through touch. I mean, it's the air that's touching you too.
Right, everything.
But it's the sound, the crickets or whatever, and then your eyes.
Right.
Al, did you have
anything? Yeah, I wanted to say a word in defense of not seeing.
All right.
Okay.
I'm not sure the analogy is apt, but let me try it. Political discourse is full of criticism of labels, the tyranny of labels. So that labels, whether it's conservative, liberal, neo-orthodox, so forth, these words kind of stop thought, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
But they also enable us to organize thought. I mean, classification enables us to deal with the voluminous information of the world.
Right.
Without classification, we wouldn't be able to communicate.
With the chaos.
With the chaos.
It would be chaos without. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I don't want to see all the time. I want to be selective about seeing. If I try to see everything in its infinite detail, I may not be able to see anything.
Yeah.
And I need to conserve my seeing energy, so
to speak. Yeah, I think that's a good point to end on, because as I said yesterday, it's too intense for me to be painting and work as an artist all the time. And I can't do it. I think what I'm trying to do by this is saying, I think we have gone too far the other way of organizing, hitting the labels, and not stopping enough to see that they're both part of being human. The ability to organize in the chaos. I mean, the art, he didn't just throw the paint on here, although that's another question too, because that can tell us something too. But this is very, very organized, this painting. And that's a good point. Talk about using, well, in your sense, you know, the labels, the parts, because you're just saying, hey, I don't want to do this all the time.
But
the artist is doing both, though, I think, in this specific case. But notice, it's a very limited size. It's a very specific event that he started, he worked on, and he left. But in doing that, I feel he's grown a little bit more, probably, as a person, and enriched us, too. It's 10-2, any of you who want to. But if you want to stay, that's fine.
I just feel like we need to say a real important thing in response to your comment about the word, and that 20th century Westerners and Westerners for a lot of centuries before that have gotten into a terribly devastating habit of looking at scripture and the word of God as cold, hard, intellectual word rather than as poetic word. And if we learn to read scripture the way we encounter painting, we'll come closer to God.
Hmm.
If I could piggyback on that, one of the things that I thought when you were talking was of the word being read and of just the cross and of what it means, as we might look at a symbol here at Holden, of what it means to a group of Christians in Namibia and perhaps a group of Christians in Japan. And at least having been in Japan, realizing that I'll never bring the same feelings that they bring to the cross there. So that in one sense, there's a unity in that symbol, but the reality that they come from, you know, I would take my whole life to understand and probably never could because I didn't grow up in that totally different culture.
Is anyone else? Jane?
There's something to me about experience, about the value of experience, and whereas like the Bible is words and the Bible expresses somebody's experience of God, a lot of people's experience of God, only through symbols, and you know, through the written symbol, also through the symbols that they use to show God. And
mm-hmm.
For me, that's helpful, but the more I can experience God for myself, using that maybe as a help, but the more I can experience, or whatever, the more I can experience for myself rather than taking it from somebody else's experience. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, that's a lot we talked about yesterday too, about the importance of having yourself as a mirror, I mean, like coming out of yourself. I mean, it being in the image of God, and that you, in fact, have that within you. You know, the Bible's a nice source, too, but we forget that God speaks within us, and from us, and through us.
I think it's interesting that as a, I'm up here.
I didn't see a mouth moving now.
As a writer, I don't work with words. I work with images. Okay, visual images. Partly because I deal with visual medium, but when I also write print, I do not write with organized words. I deal always first with images and what I want to get across. And it's images, not words. It's later that I check the dictionary, and later I see if it's all coming together and if the sentence structures work and if the grammar is correct. But first of all, I try to deal with what my image is that I try to communicate to others through
the word
or visual.
Yeah. Anyone else have something to say?
I would like to ask one question.
Okay.
Just ask, because there's two in my church, myself, another man that had not been Lutherans all our life. I feel that we're all adults here, and I'd like to ask this question. This question was, he asked the group, and he didn't understand. Now, I will tell you a little of my background, because I was in the cult first, and I think God works in many ways, and so I feel happy here. But he asked the question, he felt it, he was always, it bothered him, and it bothers me too. If we really believe, we really shouldn't fear death.
Right.
And he felt that so many Lutherans really fear death. Mm-hmm. And if you really believe, and I just wonder if people really realize that, you know, it's such a relief to not have that fear, because that is a fear.
And I don't think that's just Lutherans.
No, I but you know, if they really, really believe, why is this thing here?
Lord, I believe, but help my unbelief.
Even Jesus in the garden prayed that the cup would pass from him, that he wouldn't have to go through it. I think there must have been, humanly speaking, some fear there.
It's part
fear of the unknown.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. I think it's part of being human, of being afraid of the unknown and the different, and part of becoming more like. Oh, this is part of my theology. Becoming more godlike is learning to not be afraid of the different, learning to love the different in ourselves, in others, to grow with the different and not have that fear. But I think fear is part of life.
Excuse me, but he didn't say different. He said death.
Oh, but don't we fear death because we've not gone through it before?
Is that why we fear it?
I think that's
the end of what we know.
And the older you get, the less you fear it.
Yeah.
One of the things this is the first time in my life I've gone camping solo. I'm not far from the village, and I don't think I'm going to get eaten by a bear. But they're out there. And I'm worried that the deer will step on me. But I'm dealing with the fear, and it's crazy, because the same God that created me created all the other creatures. He's protected me at the University of Washington from being stabbed by a mugger. He can protect me out in the forest from a bear.
But does the bear know that?
Yeah.
Does the bear believe?
and as he said, if I should die, it's nothing.
It's what you leave behind that worries people, I think. And that's why when you get older, you don't have so much. You feel it, you live. And your children can take care of you.
get a chance to see it.
I think it's also knowing that your life has been part of a positive growth, a positive part of the world becoming something different.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.